Is this like the W? Do you listen to Marc Maron's podcast?
I do.
Okay,
I love it. Yeah.
Is this the vibe of yours that like it just you're just rolling? You know what
well,
I mean?
We are just rolling, and I haven't done. Okay, so this is a great question. I haven't had any guests yet this season, so let me turn this into not just rolling. Hey everybody, welcome to Chatting Between Takes, season 2, episode 4. I might be wrong. And what Jess and I are just talking about is she's asking if I'm just rolling, and I probably will use that, but I have threatened to have a guest on this season of the podcast, and it was always going to be you for the first one. So everybody watching, this is Jess Salguero, and I'm going to give her her palmares, her resume in a sec. But yeah, season 1, I did a ton of interviews, but it was audio only. We definitely had a formal intro, but what would always happen is we'd have coffee in the kitchen before, and that was the better part. Like, we never got the good. So I get why he rolls.
Yeah.
So you're just into it. So I think you're going to like this, Jess. I did 50 ep season 1, did a 6 ep drop with my dad called Conversations with My Father. And then this season I've subtitled it Chatting Between Takes, I Might Be Wrong. Because I think most of the ills in society stem from the fact that people will entrench before they'll admit the possibility that they're wrong.
Oh, wow. So the I might be wrong is just like a disclaimer for yourself.
It's a disclaimer for myself. And it's like, you know, Fast and Furious 2, this time it's personal, like that kind of thing. Although cool. I think that might've been the tagline for Jaws 3. I'm not even kidding. This time it's the shark's personal. Okay. Everybody, I'm talking to Jess Salguero, who is easily, she knows this, one of my favorite people on the planet. I call her a best friend. I'm privileged enough to have, you know, we're friends, we work together, we break down all the acting stuff together, we're confidants and everything in between. You might know her as the Mean Nanny on Working Moms, Robin on The Boys, Letterkenny, Marianne, The Expanse, Chandra. I haven't seen that show. I've watched pieces of it to audition for it, but everybody loves that show, so I have to catch up. Tiny Pretty Things, she plays Officer Isabel Cruz. And then shows you haven't seen yet are Jupiter's Legacy and Why the Last Man. Aside from basically being an incredible person, Jess is also one of the most talented and most busy actors on the planet. How's it going, Jess? What's going on?
You're so good at this.
Oh, thanks. I'm laughing at you hearing yourself be introduced by me.
Yeah, it's seriously. I'm like, oh wow, he like has it there. He has it like written out. Yeah. Like that's wow. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean that to sound patronizing.
No. You're in so guest mode, so you get the treatment.
Whoo. How am I doing? I'm doing good.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I just let the dog in my room?
You like, do your thing. I'm literally making tea while we have this chat. I think one of the greatest gifts of this whole COVID Zoom thing is that we've deformalized even further in all the right ways. Like,
agreed.
Who gives a shit if your dog's there and making tea?
And you might hear her drinking water in the back.
That's not okay. that's not okay for the sorry, you're fucking my podcast.
Sorry.
I literally have goggles behind me on my wall. I haven't swum with goggles since the 80s.
You know what? Know what I think is funny in your background? Is that a katan?
There's a katana, yeah. This is a full samurai sword.
Wow.
Yeah, let's see. That's for the audio only people. I tried to make it sound like Kill Billy.
Oh my god, that's so cool. Do you think that just is a decoration? Is it decoration or is it like a...
No, it's one of the arts I do called Iaido. It's the like drawing and cutting of the samurai sword.
So cool.
Yeah, oh, there's your dog in the back. What's your dog's name?
Soluna.
Soluna?
Yeah, like sun, moon.
What a great name.
Yeah.
Soluna, I love that. I didn't like that dog before you told me her name. And now I'm a fan.
She just got groomed today. So she's like, she smells good. She's sitting on my bed.
She's feeling herself.
Yeah, big time.
That's pretty good. Okay, so let's get it. Tell me about growing up. Tell me what it was like being you. and tell me as much of that as you want as pertains to your path to, like, why not be an actor?
Okay. And please tell me if my audio cuts out or something else.
Sounds great.
I grew up in Winnipeg to...
Which I love.
You know, I love Winnipeg in a way. I did not like growing up there in that I was very bored and very cold. A lot of my life. I actually really love people from Winnipeg. But anyway, I grew up there and my parents were Portuguese immigrants. So we were really close to the Portuguese community. And also my parents moved to a suburb when I was born and there were no Portuguese people in this mm-hmm. suburb. So it was interesting because I felt like I lived kind of a double life as a kid where I had this very culturally and emotionally expressive Portuguese family. Mm-hmm. And then I had this, all my friends in my neighborhood who were super waspy, and it was just different. It was different. I was also used to hearing Portuguese around and at home or with my cousins, and then all my friends in my neighborhood, like, they didn't know, everyone thought I was adopted because they were like, they didn't really understand
that house with that difference.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they all thought I was adopted because they thought that anyone who's kind of brown is probably adopted.
So this is something you and I have talked about a lot. Cause I have immigrant parents and my mom was German. Yeah. So we had a total, like, I was raised European 100%, like, not raised Canadian, but because it's German Irish, I look like every other kid. Now we've talked about this. I never clock that you're other or different, but you grew up with a sense of that, right? Like,
yeah, in a way, but then I don't know. I feel like I'm in a weird position because I'm technically European. Does that mean I'm Caucasian, even mm-hmm. though I don't feel like I present Caucasian? Also, there's a lot of things with my ancestry that would also add some more to the mix of what composes me and my family. But anyway, it's, yeah, othered, I guess, but to be honest, I think that the fact that I had older siblings that were very proud to be Portuguese, like older sisters, I felt like it was okay. Like, I knew that kids at school were ignorant. Like, I actually knew what was happening. I didn't think, oh my God, I'm lesser than, or they don't want to come to my house because we talk loud and our food smells weird. Like, I didn't think that I was, I didn't take it too personally. And I think it's because I have older sisters to be able to talk to me about that.
Yep.
So yeah, along with, you know, how I grew up, definitely being the youngest of three sisters was super formative. And they're a lot older than me, meaning they're 12 and 10 years older than me. So it's almost like I had three moms growing up. And
well, psychologically, that can be considered only child, right? With that, it's 5 years apparently. And my brother and I are on the cusp, but you know, there's a thing where you're not interacting socially in a way that makes it as sibling as almost only child. I've read.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. That's really interesting. Also, they both moved out when I was 12, so I kind of became an only child.
Right.
At 12. So yeah, and I'd say that without getting like too far into like my family dynamic, there was a lot of there was a lot of angst and tension and emotionality in my house growing up. And I felt that as the youngest and as someone who was much younger than everybody, I could witness it in a different way.
Okay, what way? Because I want to talk about this because I know I have that same feeling and I'm curious if it's a similar way.
Yeah, it very much might be because we're both actors now, but I think it has a lot to do with why I am an actor. I would see, for example, one of my sisters fighting with my mom, and I would know what they actually wanted, but were unable to say because I was a kid. I'd be like, oh, they just want a hug. Or like, oh, mom just wants someone to acknowledge how hard she's working. Like, it was just, I think it's because of my innocence of being that much younger that I saw the subtext.
I am so shocked we've never talked about this because my therapist has literally talked to me a decade ago about the curse of Cassandra, one of the I believe it's a Greek myth where she could perceive the truth at all times but couldn't express it. And that's what I felt like in my house. Like, you're watching and you're like, all you have to do is say this and it ends, or all you meant to say was this, but this sentence is where it got confused. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I do think it's a gift of being a younger child, and it's also the curse because you go, what the fuck? Like, why is nobody getting this? But there's no way to express it in a way that'll be heard.
Oh gosh, that's you nailed it. That's exactly it. It's exactly it. You have, no one's going to listen to you, especially when they're in the heat of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's too much pride to even be able to hear what a kid's saying often.
Yeah.
I love that, Cassandra. Yeah, yeah. No, that's exactly it.
So let me ask you, and maybe we won't crack this open, but what is that? Like, why would that, because I know so many of us actors have this in common. What would lead that to make you or me, why does one become an actor when that's, why is that a piece of it?
I think it's like a fascination with human behavior after that, because you see all the layers. So it's sort of like, oh, wow, that's so interesting. Like, my sister is 16 years old and super insecure about her body. So when my mom makes a comment about something she's eating, she's going to react in a closed down way because she doesn't know what else to do because she's scared she's going to cry in front of everyone and have to explain her insecurity. It's like, as a kid, just putting the pieces together, being like, wow, humans are so complicated. Wow. Like, and I think I just always felt like if we could get down to the subtext and get to understand it better, whether that be for myself and, you know, I think it is helpful for everybody, that it's kind of a, I don't want to say a noble pursuit, that's not the right word, but it's something that's going to help heal me, heal my relationships, make me a better listener. And so I just always felt like leaning into that would be a way to resolve a lot of conflict, which I think was like all I wanted to do.
Oh, amen. Amen. I totally get that. And I wonder, I mean, I know for me only, I'm minting this idea today, but the control that I actually got to have performing, because you could almost resolve the broken game. Like, the parents have the broken communication going on, but in the scene, you actually get to go fuck you and leave, or stop it, I love you, and grab them and kiss them. And that gets to happen in the drama, but it didn't happen in real life. So it's like, I get to put a button on all these unfinished moments.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. You get to rewrite the story.
Yeah. I love buttons in scenes, right? Like, some people don't, like, I'm a old school romantic that way with scenes, where it's like, let's put the button on it. And I think that's part of it for me. It's not good or bad. It's just, I'm hearing what you're saying and going, oh, right.
Yes, for sure. For sure. And
yeah,
I was just going to say, I mean, in terms of also the reinforcing the acting thing, which is something that I've learned recently. One of my nieces asked my sister what I was like as a kid. And my sister said, oh, she just always wanted everyone to be laughing. Mm. She was always trying to make everybody laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought about myself like that or never remembered myself like that. But I think that was also part of the whole performing too, mm-hmm. was okay, I'm going to do something funny. I'm going to be silly because this alleviates some of the tension in the house. When the cute younger sibling is being a goofball.
Yeah.
So I think that was part of all of it.
And also I imagine being a kid that laughs are one of the really clear ways that it's working. Like if you're doing a dramatic moment, you don't really know if your folks are getting it. But if you make them laugh, you're like, that worked.
Oh yeah.
It's like the easy way to know your thing worked.
Oh my gosh, still to this day, I think the most satisfying moments in my life are when I make my family laugh. And I haven't realized, I again wasn't conscious about this until like maybe a year ago. And every time since when I've made my family laugh, I go, holy shit, that's so satisfying.
Well, this is something I'm jealous of with you, because if you look at the work you get to do, you kind of bounce between the two very nicely. Right. Yes. I mean, the ninth. Okay, that's one I didn't even mention. I mean, this is this CBC Gem series that you know I adore. I think you all nailed it. And everybody, you know, you're all going to end up watching The Boys for the people listening, or maybe that's why you're here. But go watch The Ninth on CBC Gem. It's so delightful and awesome and funny. And it's something you've been able to balance really well, I think.
Sorry, the dog.
Yeah, no problem. He wants to leave. Fucking soul, Luna. I knew I hated you for a reason.
Yeah, and thank you for saying that. Yeah. I bounce between it. I feel so lucky that I've so far been able to do that, because that's the dream. And honestly, when you get to work on comedies, it's so fun to go to work. It's always fun to go to work, but you know what I mean? Like when you have to do a heavy scene, it's satisfying in another way. Absolutely. Yep. But it's not necessarily fun. Mm-hmm. It scratches a different itch, I guess. But going to work on a comedy is just, it's a blast. Like Letterkenny is, I've never had so much fun. The problem with that job is I have to try to not laugh. Like the whole time I've ruined so many takes because I burst out laughing, usually at Kelly McCormick.
Oh, you two are genius. You're genius. And the writing, of course, is just giving, it's so good.
It's so good. And it's really like the vibe on that set is so chill, and like they have, you know, kind of a system of how they shoot things now. And it's just, yeah, it's so fun. And I'm like, whoa, some actors just do comedy.
I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine how amazing that would be. I mean, look, I've gotten so close to so many comedies, and then those are the only ones I'm mad that didn't go my way. Mm. The odd drama doesn't go my way. I'm shooting a drama a month later anyways. But there's only so many comedies that line up with my juice. And when I miss them, I'm like, no, because that's all I actually want to do. So let's keep going with you, though. Let's get in. So when is it that you start connecting to the concept of either acting or art as a real thing versus, you know, just perceiving and making people laugh in your household?
Well, I always wanted to do it. I was very secretive about it. My mom says, in grade six, when I was in sixth grade, I did like this school musical, and it was about a princess and this knight, and I played the knight. Like I played a boy's role. and I was a lead, and I it was a musical, and I had to sing all these songs. And my family came to the musical, and they said they had no idea that I had been practicing singing. My parents worked a lot, but my mom said, I had no idea that you like were doing a play, that you were the lead, and that you had a bunch of solo songs. Like, when did this happen? And I was so secret. I was just very secretive about things. It's my Scorpio-ness, I guess. And so from then on, luckily, my parents, were like, okay, maybe she should, I don't know, we should put her in something. We don't know what. We live in Winnipeg, and no one in our family is an artist. So I started taking dance class, and then I did dance for most of my teenage life. And then when I was 18, I was teaching musical theater at the dance school, and one of the other teachers came up to me and was like, she's like, you want to get out of here, don't you? She meant Winnipeg. And I was yeah. And she's like, I think you should audition for this school in Toronto, and I think you should go. And I was like, okay.
Oh
It
God, is this a guy or a gal who's,
was a gal.
God bless this woman.
I
God
know.
bless this. Have you thanked her since? Have you?
You know what? I don't think I've actually, I will. Like, I've thought about this a lot, and there were two teachers that kind of encouraged me. But I need to give her like
What an
a
incredible thing. I mean, I'm older than you, but I think about when you see something in someone and you actually give them a push, they might not. I mean, imagine what your life could be if, I mean, you'd have found it some way, but you might not have found this.
No, I agree. Like, I think coming to Toronto was really important.
So was that
Because,
Randolph you auditioned and
yeah, I auditioned and I got in, and so I came. I like did not look back. I was like, okay, I'm gone. And I moved here, and I loved it, and I loved school, and I definitely came out of school as an actor more than a dancer. Or a singer, but love all three. And then and then I had a theater company. I did mostly theater my whole 20s.
Was there a mandate? Was there a vibe to it? Was there a this is
Yeah,
the kind of theater?
we were doing Absurdist.
What? How have we never talked about this? We talk all the time. You did Absurdist. This is like how I got into acting after theater school.
is I feel like, did have we talked about this? Maybe we just fence it off each other.
Probably why we get along, because it's all absurdism.
It is.
I think
So yeah,
Euro folks understand that in a different way too. I don't know why, but I mean, it's born out of that culture and born out of the war type. Like the wars didn't land and bomb buildings in North America, right? World War I and II destroyed continents. So they inherently understand absurdism in a way that we don't have to. But as ancestors of it, I think we might have it in us.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes so much sense. Yeah, we did like Eugene Ionesco plays, and
Fabulous.
we
And this
actually,
was your company.
yeah,
So
we were called Art and Lies.
let me break this down, because look, for the listeners, like I don't know if you get this, but Toronto is a very vibrant theater scene. And the I just love the idea, Jess, that you're what, like 21, and you're like, I'm going to start a theater company, and we're going to do absurdism.
I know.
Like just that's even the mandate of a 21-year-old's way of looking at the world. I love it.
Well, to give credit where it's due, I started it with one of my teachers at Randolph, and she was really into absurdism. And it was definitely her, she inspired us. Like, it was her passion that really, is what that's how I found it, was through her. So her name's Rosanna Saracino, and she's amazing.
That's awesome. I also think that like all the best teachers I've had in my life, and the kind of teacher I try and be when I teach, is that you're still just in the thing, doing the thing, and you're looking for young people to bring into the fold and be like, you seem like you kind of get this, because it can't just be a generation. It can't be a bunch of 45-year-olds. It's got to be the, whether it's karate or fucking acting, like you need the young people in your theater company giving it lifeblood.
That's
what
so
a cool
true.
Thing.
That's so true. And I actually really respect her that she was open to that, you know, because I think it'd be like easy to be like, I'm not working with amateurs, but she was like, hell yeah, let's do this.
I think there's a saying, and it might even be like the awful Cone character in Angels in America, but to be successful, you need an older person to take an interest in you. And I remember clocking that and being like, wow, I danced around that, but I actually rejected a lot of people who would have been mentors because I could do it on my own. And it sounds like you didn't. It sounds like you embraced that a little.
Oh man. Yeah. No, I don't have ego around that. I need mentors. I want mentors. Like, I want mentors all the time. Yeah. I think it's also like, I think it is a bit of a gendered experience, to be honest. Like the difference in that, as a woman, and especially as a young woman growing up, like I didn't have many reference points of women who followed their own path and trailblazed and marched to the beat of their own drum. Are you kidding me? Those women were ostracized and like seen as unattractive or doomed to be alone for the rest of their lives, like unhappy bitches, like all of that. So in society, we absolutely exalt men that exemplify that kind of freedom or risk taking. And for women, like that's, I'm like so thirsty to see more of that. And especially as a young person, as an artist, the way that I felt coming out of theater school, where I was like, fuck, I'll do any, like, I'll try anything. I don't give a shit. Like, I was definitely really raw. And like, I had just done, for our graduation show, we did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I played Jack Nicholson's role as a bisexual woman. And I did nudity, and I just was, I would like, that was me coming out of theater school. I was like, let's do this.
Amazing.
And then I was like, oh wait, I think that I'm supposed to look a certain way and be a certain way in order to be digestible as a young woman in this industry. And that's years later, post my, well, sort of during my theater company, but later I went into a whole eating disorder thinking I needed to be a certain way. But when I was fresh out of theater school, I was definitely aware that I didn't quite fit in places, and I was okay with it for a while.
Right.
But it was into my mid-20s where I'm like, okay, no, I at some point want to start making some kind of a living.
Yep.
I guess I need to, just walk the footsteps of the women who've done this job before me. And all that is the same fucking carbon copy of the same woman, which is the beautiful damsel in distress. And especially as a young woman, right? Like, and so anyway, I could go on a whole.
Well, let's break this open a bit. So first off, to your credit, I do, when you're describing that character, that Randall Patrick McMurphy you did, that's still how I see you, right? Like I see you being that. Now, I also see you as having found, what's the best way to put it? That's your motor. And then you've found a nice body for the car so that it drives and people go, hey, look at that. So let's talk about that journey, because A, I think it's going to be incredibly important for anybody, especially women listening. I'm assuming. But what, how did you navigate? Oh, I think I need to be skinnier. Wait, that's not it. Oh, I think I need to look like a white chick. Oh, that's not it. That's a real gauntlet that, let's say, I went through in a different way related to artistry, but never really had to relate in terms of perception of me within a biz that just kept going leading man, leading man, leading man. So I could fall up, and I did. What was that for you? like what, get as specific as you want or not, but it's a really compelling thing for me.
That is so, sorry, that also that expression you just said about falling up is so interesting. Okay. Yeah, so I felt that the only way that anyone was gonna hire me was if I could do anything within my control to be, again, as digestible as I could be.
Digestible. So, I love that word. I love that you're using that word. I've never heard it put that way. And I think it's really important to clock that.
So yeah, it launched me into an eating disorder, exercise disorder for several years. But I mean, it was such a important moment in my life because, so 2 years into it, I still wasn't getting hired. And I was very unhealthy. I hadn't been getting my period for 2 years because I was underweight. And I was like, I was depressed. Like I was just not in a healthy frame of mind, body, heart, soul. And I told one of my sisters, okay, I'm going to quit acting. I'm done. Like I was probably 26. I was like, I'm done. Like it's not worth it. And she's like, okay, I think you need to start writing about what you're feeling. And I was like, okay. And she's like, join me and these other two women. We write together every morning at 7 a.m. on Skype. And I was like, okay. So I started Skyping with these women every morning at 7 a.m. for 2 years nearly. And they were all writing books. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. I was just like, I don't know. I'm journaling, I guess. Like, I don't know what I'm doing here. And what I uncovered in that process was, holy shit, I'm making myself small. I think that in order for a woman to be successful, she needs to be small. Like, that is what I am enacting in every way of my life right now. And so, I mean, it was very much materializing physically, but it was in every realm of my life, like energetically, spiritually, in the way I use my voice, in the way I was just small, 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 small.
Well, and if I can just interject, one thing you and I have talked about is the idea that if me as a guy wants to become powerful, I add muscle, I get big, I take up more space, and that you get really skinny and you demur or defer. And you brought that idea to my attention and I've never forgotten it. And I think, wow, what a perverse culture in which we add inches to, like literally it's just inches to a guy and go, he's powerful. Oh, we subtract inches or else she's not desirable. That's fucked up.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. And so I realized that because I wanted to heal myself, and me not getting my period was actually kind of my rock bottom in a way. When I talked to my sister about it, who's like a freaking doula, fertility guru, coach, amazing activist woman. She's like, Jess, look, I'm worried about this because, well, A, you're not getting your period because something's off in your body, but this could affect you having children one day. And it's something to be taken seriously. And when she said that, I went, oh fuck. Like, I want to have kids. And
right.
I need to get right. I need to get right with myself. I need to get right with what's going on. And so, I realized in order to heal myself, and because you know, this was definitely an eating disorder situation. I needed to start to take up space, but not just physically, because I knew that would send me down some weird other spiral.
Right.
I was like, I need to take up space in every way. And so it was kind of a little experiment, and I started to do things like wear really bright colors. I started to like really take my time in the day to like, I'd like spend so much time putting lotion on my body, or I'd like really spend a lot of time, like picking my wardrobe, being like, I'm going to take up space. Like, I'm going to be bright. I'm going to catch attention. I would wear heels or like platform heels on purpose. Like, I, in a way of like, not just like, oh, this is sexy. I was like, no, I want to be taller. Mm-hmm. I want to like experiment with every way I can take up space. And then like things like singing more. I started like singing fado music, which is this Portuguese music that I ended up writing a play about. And it was just this kind of blossoming, I guess, into like my actual adulthood in a way.
Well, I love that you just said actual, because I was actually just going to ask you that. Like, you basically took your 20s up until mid late to kind of figure out who you are and how you function in the world. And I always like to go a bit outward with the idea of these podcasts, or, you know, like for someone listening, like if I look at your resume, I go, oh, fuck, that chick just works her ass off, blah, 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 period. That's not your story. You're not shooting anything. You're literally, it sounds like, from sort of the tail end of the theater until you started to emerge into the new space, like 3-4 years of descent, reemergence through conscious writing, 2 years every morning with other women who are helping guide you through this process. And that's after hitting a bottom. Is that accurate?
Yeah, pretty much. It's
beautiful. No wonder you're so conscious. And the thing with you, you know, I mean, whether it's those first times we met or those first parties where we connected, the one thing you've always been in my perception is so present. Is mm-hmm. that you don't take up space in a way to take up space. You're just present to the conversation, present to the interaction. I see, and it's not just with me. It's not just that we get along. It's as you're talking to other people. And I clocked that from the word go. I was like, this person's so present. She's just there. And did you go too far?
No, I don't.
I've never seen it.
I don't think so, but I'm just very grateful that you think I'm present. It's funny because, I mean, I don't have to get into it now, but that's something I'm actually reintroducing myself to in another way, like just presence in general. And because I've realized that all the suffering in our lives comes from when we're not present.
we talked about this on our karate show last night, that you can get punched almost full throttle. If you see it coming, you probably won't get knocked out. But if you're looking over this way, the lightest touch on the chin can turn your lights out.
Wow.
It's the things you don't see coming, you know, because you're not present, that can be the real knockouts. And I think there's a metaphor there for what you just said. You know, when you're prepared for something and it's coming and you know it's coming and you're going to have to, it sucks. You still get hit, but you don't get knocked out. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe there's nothing there, but.
No, I hear you.
That made me think of.
I hear you.
Yeah. So when did you start booking the work? Like when did this transition to, hey, people are starting to go, that girl, not the other one?
Well, actually it was through theater, because I did a play at this tiny little theater called Sterling Theater.
God bless,
loved that theater. I did this play, and I was starring opposite this actor named Benjamin uh-huh. Ayers, who at the time was a lead on a show called Saving Hope. And so we played lovers on the show. I play his like younger love interest, and it was a freaking great part. And I got to really kind of like I just really got to play, and he is such a good person. He's such a
delight.
Great partner.
He's a delight.
Fabulous. And I've since played his love interest 4 times.
Ah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so I did this play with him, and because he was a lead on the show, all the producers from the show came to see it, and the casting directors came to see the play. And so, as it happens, the next season of the show, they were casting someone to play his younger love interest. And they called me in to audition because they'd seen me in the play and they knew we had chemistry, and I got the part. I auditioned.
Yeah.
But they, I think they were like, well, they already have really good chemistry, so we don't have to, you know, work on that. And so that led to me getting a recurring role on that show for 2 seasons, Saving Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And that really got the ball rolling.
Yeah.
I think I'd had like maybe 1 or 2 other like day player jobs on shows before that, but that was my first recurring, and it was so small. Like I would literally come in every like 2 episodes and say 1 line.
Right.
But it got me comfortable-ish with how sets work, because I feel like that's 95% of our job.
Yes.
Being comfortable on a set. It's so hard.
Well, I'm looking at it here. You did 11 episodes according to IMDb, and that means that's 11 episodes where you don't have to carry the show, but you get to be around how it all gets carried. And I think that's something that young actors forget sometimes, because some friend of yours is the 19-year-old lead on a show, and so you think you should be. And then you get mad when you realize they had parents who were actors or they were kid actors, but that's how it kind of should work, because you don't know how a set works yet. You don't even know what a focus puller is yet. And so it's going to be a real deep end if you don't sort of have what you'd call a gradual, you know, build. And, you know, Emily Coots, who's a friend of Jess's and mine, and I once said to her, like, I wish for you a gradual growth. And she wasn't kind of sure what I meant until she started working and went, I totally get what you mean, and I'm glad I don't have to carry this show right now.
Oh, 100%.
I had to carry a show out of the gate, and I couldn't. It was too much.
Wow.
I don't attribute that for my drug stuff, but it contributed in that I really wasn't sure how to do the thing. Acting wise, yes, but the whole day's worth, no.
Oof.
So you got that out of the gate, which is so beautiful. You got to feather in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask you a question, and maybe you do or don't have an answer for this, but what would you say to a 20-year-old actor, male or female or non-binary, who says, yeah, but how do I get the confidence to book work walking into those rooms and be present when I've never booked work? How do you do that?
It is hard. It's obviously that like weird catch 22 thing. But honestly, for me, it was theater. It was like doing stuff I had control over, or being in class. It was like, yes, it helps to perform in front of people, and it helps to make mistakes in front of people.
Yeah.
And so it's practice, and that's auditioning too, right? And so if you can do it in a controlled environment where the stakes are less high, like in class or on stage, it's always kind of high too, but let's say improv, right? Like just being in front of people and performing and starting to trust yourself. Like I always say to young actors, I'm like, get in an improv class or I mean Meisner too is great, but I mean there's tons of different classes that are great.
Yeah.
But why I like improv and why I like Meisner is it teaches you to trust your instincts.
So
it's really familiar with your instincts, you know?
I love that you're saying this because, you know, for the people listening, I teach. And one of the things that I get asked a lot, or if I identify like a 20-year-old who's super talented, is how does someone get an agent? And the thing is that my answer is like, look, I don't know where you get one through, you know, and I'm not trying to be old dude jokey here. Like there's somebody getting an agent out of TikTok or a great Insta story feed. Like I get that. But the only thing I know how to do is make a great short movie or get in a play that gets some notice. And if it does, just do the plays because you would anyways. Like, what are you doing not acting if you're an actor? Like a fighter fights, a swimmer swims, an actor acts. And so if you're in the downtime, that should be a downtime from other people hiring you and clocking you. It shouldn't be a downtime from you acting. And it sounds like you followed that same path that I did, which by the time I shot my first series lead, I had been in front of an audience for over 250 nights. Because I did, I think, 12 or 13 plays. That doesn't even include days rehearsing. You know, that's if you add up how many days you and I have shot in the last 3 or 4 very successful years, it probably doesn't equal 250.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you can have a great year and shoot 15 or 30 days.
It's so true. Yeah. It was so funny. I remember the first time I said that to an old roommate of mine. Her boyfriend was like curious why I'm always home. And he'd be like, wait, you're on a show. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, how many days do you work? I'm like,
don't tell anyone, Jess. You're giving the secret away.
Okay, I won't say. But he was very surprised. He was like, you can like live your life like that? I'm like, yeah, but listen, there's so much work in the preparation of all of this auditioning.
Yeah.
Like the time is really in auditioning, I think, in many ways.
And also who we become in between. So this is a question I have for you. Like, how do you maintain your, like my brother always says it, he goes, dude, when you have a job, I'm jealous of you. You have the best job in the world. And when you don't have a job, I'm not jealous of you. You have the worst job in the world. And he's absolutely right. Oh, I mean, when friends of mine are like, hey, I got to go for my job. I'm like, what's the issue? And they're like, they plan for their life to be on a single job site. So how do you maintain your in-between job, vitality, sense of self, or even when you're working, but it's like one of those jobs where you're going in once every 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So the salary might not even eke out to making your month's rent, but you're working.
You're
supposed to be grateful. Hashtag set life.
Oh God.
Oh God.
Sorry. Hashtag set life. Okay. It's a good question. And I think that I remember 2020 doesn't really count because 2020 was just a year of, I don't even understand.
Yeah. We're all figuring out the new world in 2020.
In 2019, I got a concussion on a set and I was out for 5 months, could not do anything. I had to pull out of a movie. And I had no idea, this is before Tiny Pretty Things, before I booked that that job, but I had no idea what was coming. And I was really scared for a while. Like especially after my concussion and in those moments, I think it's honestly class that sustains me. Like I have to keep doing it. I have to keep doing it. And honestly, the best work I've ever done in my life has been in class. It's not been in front of the camera.
No, I get that. You know, I get that.
So I have to do that. And I have to do something within my control. So it's usually something like, okay, I start writing something or, I just need to feel like I've done my diligence. And then I think it's gotten a little bit easier for me to trust that something will come. I'm sure you feel this, like, because you have your past to reference now.
Exactly.
And you've been here before. Like you've been at the point where you don't know what's next, that you can go, okay, it's like a breakup, right? It's like, you know, it's going to be hard, but you know, you're not going to die. But your first breakup, you're like, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Why didn't anybody tell me that people die?
A perfect analogy. Seriously.
I mean, you and I are so lucky that we have such good agents that really keep us encouraged and like definitely if I'm not working but my auditions are good, thank God I have an agent that'll tell me that, like that'll be like your work's good, like don't get too heady about this. Like,
and one thing you and I have talked about, and you're kind of talking about, is that that little article of faith. But we also know, like, I know when I'm auditioning for a show, technically I'm auditioning for that role, but I'm really just auditioning for the people involved, right? So I know I'm like, I checked in with my team last week in the States and in Toronto, and they're like, John, your auditions are fucking great. It'll come when it comes. We know this. I'm like, great. Just checking in case that there's something I'm going too far in one direction. But the point is that The Boys is a perfect example. You know, I was up for the Frenchie role, didn't get it, got the Ezekiel role. I was auditioning for the show, for the producers, for the casting, as much as the role that first time out. So they get a flavor and go, oh, first time we've seen this woman, maybe she's more over here. But that one might take a year or a season before they find it.
It's so true.
Or so let me jump into, because I know you as somebody who has alternately called themselves, you know, I might actually have the word wrong, but a witch, or, and I know you're a feminist, and I love, love, love how much I learn from you when we talk, because I literally just ask you questions like, what is this? Or am I off track here? And it's not even that, maybe that literal, but where does your politics, gender politics, sexual identity politics, where does that fit? Or does it need to fit? And I want to include the concept of ethnicity in this within your acting career and the work you choose to do.
Okay, the work I choose to do, that's an interesting part of it, because I'd say it's really only recently that I've become more discerning with what I do, because I think for a long time, there was a whole scarcity mentality of, oh my God, they're letting me act. I'll do whatever I want. So now I feel like I'm more discerning in terms of, is the writing good? Should I be playing this character? There's a lot of questions I'm starting to ask myself now. But I'd say in terms of, you know, how I feel about the world personally, and how I navigate that professionally. I want to be a part of shows. Ideally, I want to be a part of shows that are changing the narrative, like that in so many different ways. And doesn't have to be so obvious. If the writing's good and the writing's honest, it will be changing the narrative.
Right.
Because we have just been telling the same bullshit over and over and over again. And I want to tell stories that are like, it's 2021.
Yeah.
Like, let's stop using the formula that we've been using since the 80s, you know? And that can be, well, let's just go back to the princess, angel, damsel in distress stuff. It's like, I'm so turned off of seeing scripts where women are helpless and a man comes and somehow saves her.
Right.
I actually read something recently that was kind of following that formula. And I was like, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
Or if I do this, I want to tell them that they need to change.
Well, so then, okay. So let me ask you this. So, you know, you're in a position that has some power, and you know, you can negotiate. We know this, not every role, not everything, but where you are in the biz, as I perceive you, you get the chance to negotiate, have these conversations. Might not go your way, but you're not person X number 300 on the call sheet. When do you find, or when would you suggest, or if you could go back and talk to your young self, would you turn down some early work, or would you go, that is kind of called paying your dues, and then you break it open a bit from the inside? I mean, because there are some people who just always stick to their guns and then they blow up and have a voice, or it's the other way around. Our voice emerges from the inside.
Oh my gosh, Sean, that's the $1 million question for me. I don't know. Because I look at people that have stuck to their guns and are in so so in their integrity and they say no to things and I'm like, what? Are you crazy?
Yeah.
Like that opportunity could have led you to a bigger opportunity where you have more power and you can make better choices. And but I don't know, that path sometimes works for them and they right. are able to have a career of things that they feel proud of and you know, feel like they didn't have to compromise part of themselves for, maybe. Mm-hmm. If I could go back in time, I do feel like there were things that I kind of wish I didn't do.
Right.
But that it's always that weird thing of, I learned from it though, right? Yeah. So.
And also, did you know, because the one thing is that we're not in control of the actual product. Like I took on a role of a racist in a film and it was part of an allegory that I thought could play. And I haven't seen the finished cut, but based on the shooting, I don't think it worked. And as such, I ended up saying and doing deplorable things that I don't believe are going to pay off in any artistic way. So then I just was that guy. So not only did I have to fucking play that, but I played it to no end as of now. But I didn't know that. You know, I met with the director and I had a genuine sense of, okay, this might not be complete on the paper, but this could work. And then it didn't. So, you know, it wasn't like, fuck it, I'll turn a blind eye to my morals today. Because I wouldn't play that character today knowing how I basically know it turned out. I'd have said no. But I didn't know then. I made my best choice on the day.
Yep. I hear that. I mean, we're not in control of it, absolutely. Would I have known better at the time? Did I know? Maybe, but not really. Not enough. Like, I think I probably had a ping that it was a bit off.
Yep.
But I didn't have enough experience to trust that yet.
Yep.
And I think when I've made probably not the best decisions actually is when I'm in that state of scarcity thinking, like when I'm like, oh my God, like, I don't know what we were talking about earlier about when you're between jobs, like when you're like, I don't know what's next. Like I just need something. And then something not amazing comes along and you're
that film came along. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did we talk about this last week? Cause it's a newer idea for me that I'm working on, which is fundamentally that I can have all the same external behavior. And when I'm coming from a place of full and relaxed and faith, basically, it always works.
Yeah.
Like the text always gets the nice response or the person always, even if like they can't fit me into that project, they're like, no, but I'll have you involved. But if I do the exact same text word for word from a place of need, it always feels like the house of cards just collapses. And so what I'm working on personally is being very quiet when I'm needy, clocking it and going, this is not a bad state. It's just not the state from which to reach out and try and make big moves.
Holy crap. That's great. To add to that feeling, because your body language right now, I know people hearing this can't see it, but it reminded me, I just took this course. It was called the 10 Keys to Receiving Love, but it was this very, it was amazing. It was wonderful. And we were talking about softening and the practice of softening. And I said to the group, I think I have trouble discerning the difference between people pleasing and softening. And one woman said, for her, the distinction feels like people pleasing feels like fire in her body. It feels like grasping, like, I need to fix this. I need to do this. I need this person to understand. I need to blah, blah, blah. And she's like, softening feels like water. It's peaceful.
Mm.
It's fluid. It's there's a flow of it. It's relaxed. And making decisions from that place rather than the fireplace is how she discerns the difference. And that making it that elemental, giving that elemental metaphor for whatever reason just made so much sense to me. I went, that's the clearest distinction.
I love that. I absolutely love that. And even, you know, if you go stand at Niagara Falls and you watch right where the water's going over, it's very calm and fluid. It could kill you and crush you, but it's just going, ooh, you know, and I flip the way people talk about high vibration, which I believe is technically a positive. For me, I go the other way with it because that's buzzy. And when I get buzzy around something, anytime I think I need to do something, there's a good chance that I don't. Anytime I go, wait, that means I need to, you know, it's like, you don't need to do anything right now. That's probably, in fact, the time to sit the fuck down and, you know, do the work, whatever that work might be. You know, I was talking to my buddy Luke about this today because there's this new app Clubhouse and we both check in on it a lot. And we were laughing about the idea because there's so much networking going on and there's so much business talk on it that it can feel like you're doing something. Now, I have a... Because of the way I learn French monologues, because it doesn't come to me the way English does, I have a 48-line French monologue that I have to record for an audition for Monday. And I'm sitting here with, you know, and I've got it broken down almost mathematically for myself as a way to learn it. And it's like, you're going to go clock in and talk about networking and reach out, or you're going to get real quiet, turn the Wi-Fi off, and just learn 16 of those 48 lines today. That's all that has to happen. If you do that, you're doing the work. If you're over here, you're buzzing, I'm buzzing, but there's no work. And then I'm wondering why a day later, all that buzz feels like a hangover.
Wow.
No. Yeah.
That's like buzzy, anxiety.
Yeah. Buzzy. So when people say high vibration, for me that connects as, I know what you mean, but I have to flip that to low vibration. Like.
Love that.
Fucking yeah. How do you approach work? Is there a way? I mean, I know we work together, but is there a way on set for auditions that you want to share that can be helpful, that can make people go, oh.
Sure. I mean, I think right now I'm actually redefining some of the way I work. I think I've had to because of the nature of what I'm doing right now. The project I'm working on right now, I just really need to, I trust my instincts a lot in my work. And what I needed to do lately is I actually needed to get really specific about, certain things to do with my character. So I've actually been, and I haven't done this really since theater school, I guess, like, really mapping out my character, like really understanding things about her backstory so that I could have point of view with certain things. Cause I didn't want to be broad with it. I didn't want to be like, oh, I wanted to have a feeling about just certain things in the script. I just really needed to know where she was coming from. And, you know, fused with where I'm coming from, obviously, but
yeah,
I'd say generally with auditions, I've mostly been studying Meisner for the past 7 years. And I think what it's taught me and how it's applied so well to auditions is that it's all about relationship. Like it's all about how you feel about the person you're talking to. And that beautiful kind of alive thread between two people. And so I think that's always something that I've, in terms of auditioning, like something that I have to remember and reference when I go into an audition room, when I'm with the reader, or if I'm doing self-tapes, I'm like, oh yeah, this is like, let's really listen. Let's really be moment to moment as much as I can with these people. And it's funny, I think about acting, for me, there's three different kinds of acting. There's theater acting, there's auditioning, and then there's film and TV acting.
Ah, that's so
Oh,
good. Oh,
auditioning feels
shit.
like its own thing to me, that's different than when I'm actually doing the job.
Absolutely.
And I learned that the hard way, because I'd go to set and try to do what I did on the audition, and I'm like, oh yeah, this isn't working. but and by and other way around, like
And
I'd
vice versa.
and I'd be like, this isn't working either. With auditioning, I really want them to see me. I really want to nail very much the beginning of a scene. I want to nail the whole thing, obviously, but I'm very, especially when we're self-taping, we can do it. You don't, because you're a one-hit wonder, but not, you know what I mean? You can be one take wonder.
One hitter.
But it's easy to do it like 100 times when you're in some spiral and trying to get it all right. And I've realized that if it's between a take where it's really strong at the end, but not as strong at the beginning, I will always take the one that's strong at the
Always,
beginning.
always,
And
always.
so it's about making an impression, because people are not going to continue watching. So it's about making a choice, showing them who you are. For me, what's worked a lot with comedy is I improv a lot with comedic auditions, like especially at the end of the scene, I'll like keep going. And yeah, it just feels like it's like show them you.
Yeah.
Like I'll watch it back and I'll be like, okay, is that generic or is that me? I'm like, okay, yeah, I give them
Oh,
some.
I love that. Is that generic or is that me? Because generic's the kiss of death, right? It might get you a day player, it might get you a guest lead, but I don't think it's going to get you a career. I really don't.
Yeah.
That's my belief.
Yeah.
I'd rather make a big mistake that shows me or something, not on purpose, because a mistake means I thought it was the right answer.
Yeah. For sure.
So by the way, I posted real late that we were doing this, but I got a question from one person named Dallas who drops into my DMs every now and then. Don't know Dallas, but Dallas, thanks for the question. Very simply, I think Dallas likes The Boys. What was your favorite moment shooting The Boys?
Oh, hi, Dallas. I mean, working with Jack was awesome, and our director was so easy to it we got to improv. Like there's actually improv in the scenes that Jack and I did together. And they were just so good about it. I don't know, that set was just so magical in terms of them being like,
Yeah.
yeah, just like, I don't know, just do what you
It was
want.
magical.
Okay.
Magical.
So yeah, just working with Jack across the board was the best part of
Yeah.
it all.
You had you shot your stuff with him earlier than me, and by the time he and I did the meat of the work he and I did together, it was just understood that there would be a take to get everything set. And then there'd be about five takes for him to try his alts. And it was all, and he'd write them the night before as well. Like, and some of them were in the moment, some of them were written the night before. And he'd just kind of be like, hey, this one, the end of this one is but like jazz. And then I'm like, I have no idea what he's gonna say. And then he just does this whole bit about playing my butt like jazz or whatever. And you're just like, and then you're the great thing is he's only given the cue. But anyways, what you experienced early on grew. And was just magnificent, got even better.
Oh, he's so well cast.
Yeah.
He is so well cast.
But also what a treat, right? I mean, let's think about a show like this that, like, I think other shows could take an example because this is one of the most successful shows in the world. And the feeling on set every single time I was there, not once, was of this is expansive, let's try things, let's play. Let's get a camera on the thing we didn't realize was going to happen, but just happened. And I've been on shows that don't have that much responsibility to a budget and Sony's shareholders that are so tense about, it's got to be just like this. It's got to be just like this. And I'm like, does it though? And I'll work that way because I can, but I don't think it's where you're going to get people's best juice.
You're so right. Yeah. It's so true. It's like, I often think about it in terms of, you know, when I worked in restaurants, the best manager I ever had was someone who diligently hired the right people. So he hired right, so he didn't have to micromanage. And we had such a good time working at this restaurant together. Oh. It was my last serving job, and it was the one that was the hardest to leave because I had such a blast working there. Mm-hmm. And it had so much to do with his hiring process. And I think about it in terms of like even the boys, diligent casting process. Ooh. And like they hired the right people.
Yeah.
So they can trust
them. Really did. Sarah Kay, Jenny Lewis, big shout out, because you just keep nailing that show.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like me and Jack had chemistry. I'd do a chemistry read with him for like an hour and a half, where we just had to improv for like an hour and a half. And I remember I had the stomach flu and I was like barely made it in there. I was like, I might puke in front of everybody, but it's
okay. Also, you know, you talked about relationship earlier in terms of acting, and the sad thing, and I get it, it's nobody's fault, but it's how few chemistry reads happen anymore.
Yeah.
You can get cast as a series lead sometimes without ever meeting your co-star before you get to, you know, the early stages of prep. And I get it. I know why sometimes someone's busy and working, but what a great thing that you got to do that and actually be across the camera.
Yeah. I mean, if they don't have time to do it in the auditioning process, at least do it before you go to camera.
Right.
You know, I think it helps. Like the show I'm doing right now, we have rehearsals all the time and I'm so grateful for it. It makes such a huge difference.
Yeah. So, you know, we're well over an hour here, and I think it's a nice time to wind down. But one question I want to ask before I give you all the last words to shout out or promote or just bring up any topic you want. I just like this question. We actually introduced it in our karate show, and it, you know, sounds like you're 85 years old, but greatest achievement thus far, greatest regret thus far?
Oh, fuck. greatest achievement, honestly, would be I wrote a play in 2012 with my theater company, and it was a two-hander, and it had to do with I got to do Portuguese fado singing in it. The other actress was an opera singer who sang opera in it. Anyway, I wrote it, we performed it at the Winnipeg Fringe, got Best of Fringe. We performed it in Toronto, and I've never felt more proud of the day we set up our set in Winnipeg, and my parents did all the set for it. Like, 'cause my dad has a furniture company. So
that's incredible.
All the furniture. My sisters stood outside the hockey arenas, handing out flyers for the show. The whole Portuguese community came out, interviewed me and would come and be in the audience. And something about doing it in my hometown with that community, with my whole family there, and the show being a success and being so satisfying to do in so many ways for me as an artist, and having gotten and making a little bit of money from it, it was the best like summer of my life. Amazing. Like I was amazing. Like on such a high, because it was also as for better or for worse, I felt like I had full control over what just happened in my life. Like I wrote this thing,
yeah.
I produced this thing, I'm acting in this thing. So I could imagine, as someone who's a creator, someone who writes and really is part of the process of birthing a project, it would be so satisfying on so many levels, more than I think just being one of those roles. It's so satisfying to like, it was your vision.
Beautiful. Before we get to regret, you know, you've mentioned the word control a lot, and you're one of the few people I know for whom that seems to be a positive notion. And I say that as in the sense that most people I know who are seeking control, they should be doing the opposite. And I even count myself among that a bit. But it seems in your case that it comes from a very genuine place of just having a bit of say in the path in a way that doesn't seem, you know, egoic. Or so how do you find a balance between wanting control, but you are a woman I know who is a woman of surrender.
That's so cool. What a interesting observation. Wow. Well, okay. Whether you believe in astrology or not, I am a triple water sign. And once that has been explained to me, I understand it on such a deeper level in myself. I am so watery, meaning I'm so adapt. I go with the flow very easily. I'm very adaptable. I don't know if it's about being the younger sibling too, where I just like fit into what everyone else is doing. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it feels like deciding to take control is not my default. My default is to surrender right. to what everyone else is doing and just like, okay, yeah, sure, I'll do this. Like be pulled in a million directions and be like, yeah, I can do that. I can handle that. And I feel like I have quite a bandwidth for a lot. So I'll be like, yeah, okay, sure. So taking control just is like a radical thing for me to do.
Right. I love that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Greatest regret.
Oh God. I'm like, how much do I want to share on the podcast about my regrets? Biggest regret. I'd say one of them. I'll say one that's not like too personal, I guess. Not traveling more in my 20s. Like I actually waited around because I thought I was supposed to, because the phone might ring. And like, oh my gosh, I had a trip to go to China with my dad booked. I was gonna leave in a few days and I got a call back for a lead in a series. And my agent was even like, go on your trip.
Right.
Like, right. Go on your trip. And I was like, I can't like this opportunity. He's like, if they want you bad enough, they will have you like go on your trip. But I didn't. I canceled my trip.
I get that. We've all done that.
And I didn't get the part. Uh-huh. I didn't get the part. And it's one of those moments where I'm like, fuck, you know, like my agent was right. Like if they want you bad enough, they're going to have you.
That's right. That's right.
So go live your fucking life. And traveling is going to make you way better of an actor than working one season on a like not even very good show. Will.
Yeah.
So it's I think all the regrets was just like when I didn't go on adventures that I could have. And it was all about scarcity. It's like when I made any decisions out of scarcity, and I still do.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'll never work again. I'll never get this chance. I'll never blah, blah, blah. It's like,
yeah.
Water, man, all that ease. You know what I mean?
You know, I know what you mean. It's funny because that is actually one of my, you know, I made some choices that led to regrets. The choices themselves, who cares? But what it led to, and one of them was that, you know, an old girlfriend of mine called it the actor's passport. She was a really successful actor. And she goes, we get this thing called the actor's passport where people will be like, you can call up NASA and be like, I'm researching a part for I'm playing an astronaut, and they'll welcome you. Like, it's a crazy passport when you're a working actor. And I didn't take advantage of it in my 20s, including with travel. And I also mean travel to different worlds and environments, you know, like the bar and the Coke dealer is not an actor's passport. That's not a good use of it. Once, maybe 10 times most, but you know, let's go overseas. Let's go do the stuff. I really hear you on that. Mm-hmm. And I love that. What do you want to go out on, Jess? What do you want to, you want to bring me up? You want to wind her down? It's your time. And then I'm going to really hope that I don't hit the wrong button and delete all this. Oh no, there it is right there. Stop recording at the bottom.
Should I just plug what's next for me?
Plug what's next for you. What's going on? What's next?
Okay, well,
what should we look for?
Netflix show called Jupiter's Legacy coming out May 7th.
Mm-hmm. Can't wait to see this. Cannot wait to see this.
And that's, I don't know release dates for anything else. So I'll keep it at that.
Well, that's plenty.
So nice.
It's so nice for me too.
What a great conversation.
Thank you. And thank you for the conversation. This is the best inaugural video podcast I could have asked for.
Oh my gosh, it's a video, right? I hope I didn't do anything like I turned off my self view. Like I turned off my
Okay. Yeah, I've got a gallery for obvious reasons because that's what's recording.
I need to turn off my self view because otherwise I just look at myself.
Right. And look, when I watch the recording back and post it to YouTube, we'll see. Maybe it'll go person to person. I'm not sure. I'm figuring this all out as I go. There was the one thing where you went back and you smacked your dog 8 times.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I think some people might be a little, you know, I like what she said about water, but she's a dog beater. So, hey, we're complicated.
Well, you guys would have seen I unbuttoned my pants. That's another thing. That's okay.
Hey, I'm not wearing pants.
I'm a human.
Do you count pajama pants? I've spent the last year in pajama pants and track pants.
I know. I wore actual pants today and I'm like,
you look what? Fabulous. It's great. It's great. Well, I'm glad you remembered it was video. So you got your ring light out and all that. It doesn't matter. I look like fucking.
This isn't a ring light. It's just.
Oh, that's your natural. Yeah, it's really good. That's all what all these lights try and recreate. Well, let's call it a day. Thanks everybody for listening to Chatting Between Takes, season 2. I believe it's episode 4. I might be wrong. Oh, let's go out on that. Where do you sit with that? I might be wrong idea.
I might be wrong. Like,
yeah.
Relating
to society, to work, any of it. Does any of that connect for you? Does it matter?
Oh, no, it's, well, it brings you back to presence in a way, right? Like that this is the truth right now. But like from any other vantage point, it might look wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it very well might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the best advice that I have at the at this moment. But you talk to me in a year and I'd be like, no, that was awful advice.
Yeah.
No,
I even love it. The people I know, like my karate teachers and stuff, who I grew up looking at as talking in absolutes that I aspired to, when you get a little more mature, they're kind of like, you know, I just mean 80% of the time, right? You're like, what? It's like, well, come on, you have to leave. Everything's got the chaos element.
Wow. I like that, actually.
I'd even put my, like, you know how I teach acting. I'm like, take what you like, leave the rest. This is, what the fuck do I know? What the fuck does anyone know?
No,
man. Yeah. Well, that's awesome.
Like being in your class.
Well, too. Yeah, it's not for me. It's for you guys.
Hmm.
Thank you, Jess. You're the best. You know, I adore you. Okay. And I'm sure I'll see you on Roncy in like 3 days for a coffee.
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah.
Have an awesome Friday.
Bye.
Bye.
Too. Bye.